Pascal, as he was tinkering with an idea for a perpetual motion machine. It's basically a large bowl with partitions called frets that are shaped like thin slices of pie. When the wheel is spun, a marble first bounces along the rim of the bowl, but eventually comes to rest in one of the compartments, which are numbered 1 through 36, plus 0 and 00 on American roulette wheels. The bettor's job is simple: to guess on which compartment the marble will land. The existence of roulette wheels is pretty good evidence that legitimate psychics don't exist. For in Monte Carlo, if you bet $1 on a compartment and the marble lands there, the house pays you $35 plus your initial dollar. If psychics really existed, you'd see them in places like that, hooting and dancing and pushing wheelbarrows of cash down the street, and not on websites calling themselves Zelda Who Knows All and Sees All, and offering 24-hour free online love advice, in competition with about 1.2 million other web psychics, according to Google. For me, both the future and, increasingly, the past, unfortunately, appear obscured by a thick fog. But I do know one thing. My chances of losing at European roulette are 36 out of 37. My chances of winning, 1 out of 37. That means that for every $1 I bet, the casino stands to win 36 out of 37 times $1 minus 1 out of 37 times $35. That comes to 1 37th of a dollar, or about 2.7 cents. Depending on my state of mind, it's either the price I pay for the enjoyment of watching a little marble bounce around a big shiny wheel, or else the price I pay for the opportunity of having lightning strike me in a good way. At least that is how it is supposed to work. But does it? Only if the roulette wheels are perfectly balanced, thought Jagger. And he had worked with enough machines to share Moshe's point of view. He was willing to bet they weren't. So, he gathered his savings, traveled to Monte Carlo, and hired 6 assistants, one for each of the casino's 6 roulette wheels. Every day, his assistants observed the wheels, writing down every number that came up in the 12 hours the casino was open. Every night, back in his hotel room, Jagger analyzed the numbers. After 6 days, he had not detected any bias in 5 of the wheels, but on the 6th wheel, 9 numbers came up noticeably more often than the others. And so on the 7th day, he headed to the casino and started to bet heavily on the 9 favored numbers: 7, 8, 9, 17, 18, 19, 22, 28, and 29. When the casino shut that night, Jagger was up $70,000. His winnings did not go without notice. Other patrons swarmed his table, tossing down their own cash to get in on a good thing. And casino inspectors were all over him, trying to decipher his system or, better, catch him cheating. By the 4th day of betting, Jagger had amassed $300,000. Now, the casino's managers were desperate to get rid of the mystery guy, or at least thwart his scheme. One imagines this being accomplished by a burly fellow from Brooklyn. Actually, the casino employees did something far more clever. On the 5th day, Jagger began to lose. His losing, like his winning, was not something you could spot immediately. Both before and after the casino's trick, he would win some and lose some. Only now he lost more often than he won, instead of the other way around. With the casino's small margin, it would take some pretty diligent betting to drain Jagger's funds. But after 4 days of sucking in casino money, he wasn't about to let up on the straw. By the time his change of luck deterred him, Jagger had lost half his fortune. One may imagine that, by then, his mood, not to mention the mood of his hangers-on, was sour. How could his scheme have suddenly failed? Jagger at last made an astute observation. In the dozens of hours he had spent winning, he had come to notice a tiny scratch on the roulette wheel. This scratch was now absent. Had the casino kindly touched it up so that he could drive them to bankruptcy in style? Jagger guessed not, and checked the other roulette wheels. One of them had a scratch. The casino managers had correctly guessed that Jagger's days of successes were somehow related to the wheel he was playing, and so overnight, they had switched wheels. Jagger relocated and again began to win. Soon he had pumped his winnings past where they had been, to almost $500,000. Unfortunately for Jagger, the casino's managers, finally zeroing in on his scheme, found a new way to thwart him. They decided to move the frets each night after closing, turning them along the wheel so that each day the wheel's imbalance would favor different numbers, numbers unknown to Jagger. Jagger started losing again and finally quit. His gambling career over, he left Monte Carlo with $325,000 in hand, about $5 million in today's dollars. Back home, he left his job at the Mail and invested his money in real estate. It may appear that Jagger's scheme had been a sure thing, but it wasn't. For even a perfectly balanced wheel will not come up on 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on, with exactly equal frequencies, as if the numbers in the lead would politely wait for the laggards to catch up. Instead, some numbers are bound to come up more often than average, and others less often. And so even after 6 days of observations, there remained a chance that Jagger was wrong. The higher frequencies he observed for certain numbers may have arisen by chance and may not have reflected higher probabilities. That means that Jagger, too, had to face the question we raised at the start of this chapter. Given a set of underlying probabilities, how closely can you expect your observations of a system to conform to those probabilities? Just as Pascal's work was done in the new climate of the scientific revolution, so this question would be answered in the midst of a revolution, this one in mathematics. The invention of calculus. In 1680, a great comet sailed through our neighborhood of the solar system, close enough that a tiny fraction of sunlight it reflected was sufficient to make it prominent in the night sky of our own planet. It was in that part of Earth's orbit called November that the comet was first spotted, and for months afterward it remained an object of intense scrutiny, its path recorded in great detail. In 1687, Isaac Newton would use these data as an example of his inverse square law of gravity at work. And on one clear night in that parcel of land called Basel, Switzerland, another man destined for greatness was also paying attention. He was a young theologian who, gazing at the bright, hazy light of the comet, realized that it was mathematics, not the church, with which he wanted to occupy his life. With that realization sprouted not just Jacob Bernoulli's own career change, but also what would become the greatest family tree in the history of mathematics. In the century and a half between Jacob's birth and 1800, the Bernoulli family produced a great many offspring, about half of whom were gifted, including 8 noted mathematicians, and 3, Jacob, his younger brother Johann, and Johann's son Daniel, who are today counted as among the greatest mathematicians of all times. Comets at the time were considered by theologians and the general public alike as a sign of divine anger, and God must have seemed pretty pissed off to create this one. It occupied more than half the visible sky. One preacher called it a heavenly warning of the all-powerful and holy God written and placed before the powerless and unholy children of men. It portended, he wrote, a noteworthy change in spirit or in worldly matters for their country or town. Jacob Bernoulli had another point of view. In 1681, he published a pamphlet titled Newly Discovered Method of How the Path of a Comet or Tailed Star Can Be Reduced to Certain Fundamental Laws and Its Appearance Predicted. Bernoulli had scooped Newton on the comet by 6 years. At least he would have scooped him had his theory been correct. It wasn't. But claiming publicly that comets follow natural law and not God's whim was a gutsy thing to do, especially given that the prior year, almost 50 years after Galileo's condemnation, The professor of mathematics at the University of Basel, Peter Megrelin, had been roundly attacked by theologians for accepting the Copernican system and had been banned from teaching it at the university. A forbidding schism lay between the mathematician scientists and the theologians in Basel, and Bernoulli was parking himself squarely on the side of the scientists. Bernoulli's talent soon brought the embrace of the mathematics community, and when Megrelin died in late 1686, Bernoulli succeeded him as professor of mathematics. By then, Bernoulli was working on problems connected with games of chance. One of his major influences was a Dutch mathematician and scientist, Christian Huygens, who, in addition to improving the telescope, being the first to understand Saturn's rings, creating the first pendulum clock based on Galileo's ideas, and helping to develop the wave theory of light, had written a mathematical primer on probability inspired by the ideas of Pascal and Fermat. For Bernoulli, Huygens' book was an inspiration, and yet he saw in the theory Huygens presented severe limitations. It might be sufficient for games of chance, but what about aspects of life that are more subjective? How can you assign a definite probability to the credibility of legal testimony? Or to who was the better golfer, Charles I of England or Mary Queen of Scots? Both were keen golfers. Bernoulli believed that for rational decision-making to be possible, there must be a reliable and mathematical way to determine probabilities. This view reflected the culture of the times, in which to conduct one's affairs in a manner that was consistent with probabilistic expectation was considered the mark of a reasonable person. But it was not just subjectivity that, in Bernoulli's opinion, limited the old theory of randomness. He also recognized that the theory was not designed for situations of ignorance, in which the probabilities of various outcomes could be defined in principle but in practice were not known. It is the issue I discussed with Moishe and that Jagger had to address. What are the odds that an imperfect die will come up with a six? What are your chances of contracting the plague? What is the probability that your breastplate can withstand a thrust from your opponent's longsword? In both subjective and uncertain situations, Bernoulli believed it would be insanity to expect to have the sort of prior or priori knowledge of probabilities envisioned by Huygens' book. Bernoulli saw the answer in the same terms that Jagger later would. Instead of depending on probabilities being handed to us, we should discern them through observation. Being a mathematician, he sought to make the idea precise. Given that you view a certain number of roulette spins, how closely can you nail down the underlying probabilities, and with what level of confidence? We'll return to those questions in the next chapter, but they are not quite the questions Bernoulli was able to answer. Instead, he answered a closely related question. How well are underlying probabilities reflected in actual results? Bernoulli considered it obvious that we are justified in expecting that as we increase the number of trials, the observed frequencies will reflect, more and more accurately, their underlying probabilities. He certainly wasn't the first to believe that, but he was the first to give the issue a formal treatment, to turn the idea into a proof, and to quantify it, asking how many trials are necessary and how sure we can be. He was also among the first to appreciate the importance of the new subject of calculus in addressing these issues. The year Bernoulli was named professor in Basel proved to be a milestone year in the history of mathematics. It was the year in which Gottfried Leibniz published his revolutionary paper laying out the principles of integral calculus, the complement to his 1684 paper on differential calculus. Newton would publish his own version of the subject in 1687, in his Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, often referred to simply as Principia. These advances would hold the key to Bernoulli's work on randomness. By the time they published, both Leibniz and Newton had worked on the subject for years, but their almost simultaneous publications begged for controversy over who should be credited for the idea. The great mathematician Carl Pearson said that the reputation of mathematicians stands for posterity largely not on what they did, but on what their contemporaries attributed to them. Perhaps Newton and Leibniz would have agreed with that. In any case, neither was above a good fight, and the one that ensued was famously bitter. At the time, the outcome was mixed. The Germans and Swiss learned their calculus from Leibniz's work, and the English and many of the French from Newton's. From the modern standpoint, there is very little difference between the two, but in the long run, Newton's contribution is often emphasized, because he appears to have truly had the idea earlier, and because in Principia, he employed his invention in the creation of modern physics, making Principia probably the greatest scientific book ever written. Leibniz, though, had developed a better notation, and it is his symbols that are often used in calculus today. Neither man's publications were easy to follow. In addition to being the greatest book on science, Newton's Principia has also been called one of the most inaccessible books ever written. And Leibniz's work, according to one of Jacob Bernoulli's biographers, was understood by no one. It was not only unclear, but also full of misprints. Jacob's brother, Johann, called it an enigma rather than an explanation. In fact, so incomprehensible were both works that scholars have speculated that both authors might have intentionally made their works difficult to understand to keep amateurs from dabbling. This enigmatic quality was an advantage for Jacob Bernoulli, though, for it did separate the wheat from the chaff, and his intellect fell into the former category. Hence, once he had deciphered Leibniz's ideas, he possessed a weapon shared only by a handful of others in the entire world, and with it he could easily solve problems that were exceedingly difficult for others to attempt. The set of concepts central to both calculus and Bernoulli's work is that of sequence, series, and limit. The term sequence means much the same thing to a mathematician as it does to anybody else: an ordered succession of elements, such as points or numbers. A series is simply the sum of a sequence of numbers. And, loosely speaking, if the elements of a sequence seem to be heading somewhere toward a particular endpoint or a particular number, then that is called the limit of the sequence. Though calculus represents a new sophistication in the understanding of sequences, that idea, like so many others, had already been familiar to the Greeks. In the 5th century BC, in fact, the Greek philosopher Zeno employed a curious sequence to formulate a paradox that is still debated among college philosophy students today, especially after a few beers. Zeno's paradox goes like this. Suppose a student wishes to step to the door, which is 1 meter away. We choose a meter here for convenience, but the same argument holds for a mile or any other measure. Before she arrives there, she first must arrive at the halfway point. But in order to reach the halfway point, she must first arrive halfway to the halfway point, that is, at the 1/4-way point. And so on, ad infinitum. In other words, in order to reach her destination, she must travel this sequence of distances: half a meter, a quarter of a meter, an eighth of a meter, a sixteenth of a meter, and so on. Zeno argued that because the sequence goes on forever, she has to traverse an infinite number of finite distances. That, Zeno said, must take an infinite amount of time. Zeno's conclusion? You can never get anywhere. Over the centuries, philosophers from Aristotle to Kant have debated this quandary. Diogenes the Cynic took the empirical approach. He simply walked a few steps, then pointed out that things, in fact, do move. To those of us who aren't students of philosophy, that probably sounds like a pretty good answer. But it wouldn't have impressed Zeno. Zeno was aware of the clash between his logical proof and the evidence of his senses. It's just that, unlike Diogenes, what Zeno trusted was logic. And Zeno wasn't just spinning his wheels. Even Diogenes would have to admit that his response leaves us facing a puzzling, and it turns out, deep question.